The Tom Woods Show, episode 2043.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, chances are if you're listening to this podcast, you are surrounded by irrational, panicked people who think you're a terrible person because you don't want to lock everybody in their houses. No amount of reasoning appears to accomplish anything. And not to mention the media has done nothing but stoke fear and fail to provide context. Well, one of the many benefits you get as a supporter of The Tom Woods Show is membership inside The Tom Woods Show Elite. Recently migrated off Facebook, so if that was holding you back, no longer. This group will keep you sane and informed, and as an added bonus, it won't accuse you of wanting to kill your grandmother. Join me in there at supportinglisteners.com. Hey folks, Tom Woods here with all the crazy stuff the current regime is doing right out in the open where we can all see it. We've been distracted from some of the other things it's been doing that haven't made quite as many headlines. So I want to talk today about, we're going to talk about a bunch of things relating to cars, but eventually we're going to get to what the Biden regime is doing with regard to the automobile market and pushing it toward electric cars artificially. We got to get into that because that's going to affect every single person. It's going to affect you whether you get one of those cars or whether you're stuck getting the remainder, the other kinds of cars that are now available to you, given the restrictions they put on cars and gas mileage and so on. You're going to have a different array of choices than you had before, let's say. So we're all going to be affected by this one way or another. Now, our guest, Eric Peters, who hasn't been on in a while, is a great guy, very knowledgeable about cars and libertarianism and the overlap between the subjects of cars and libertarianism. I'm not really a car guy per se. I need to get around and I like my car, but that's to me as far as it goes. You don't have to be a car guy to listen to and enjoy Eric Peters. And the work he does for us is really important because I think he really is the only such voice out there. A lot of people who have blogs and comment on cars are completely on board with whatever the regime wants to do. But not Eric. He's a really great voice. You can find Eric at his website, Eric Peters Autos, which you can get to most conveniently at epautos.com. Eric, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
It's been quite a while. I have a few things I want to talk to you about, some relating to the state, some not. But let me start off with something that I bet, even though it doesn't touch on libertarianism, a lot of people have to face at one time or another. I have a daughter who, in a matter of weeks, is turning 17. And when she turns 18, she intends to go out on her own, as so many kids do. And it's going to be, given where we live, we don't live in a big city with a lot of public transportation. She's going to have a car. Mm-hmm. So we are going to be navigating that market. And I kind of feel like you're, you know, it probably makes sense for your first car anyway. And maybe all your cars in your life, depending on your preference, to be a used car. And we really don't know what advice to keep in mind when navigating the used car market. For example, even something like, in fact, I think I was in the, what was I in the market for? It might have been a minivan or an SUV. Maybe it was an SUV at some point. It's a while ago. And it was down to two brands. And I think I ended up getting the Hyundai Santa Fe. This was like 10 years ago. And I think Mitsubishi had a model of some kind. And I was saying to the guy, well, I do want to go try that. And he said, well, the thing to bear in mind is, however good or bad a car it is, it has a lousy resale value. This thing will sell pretty well for you when you want to get rid of it. That won't. So I also need to bear in mind, in terms of models, I can tell the resale value by looking at the price. But what is still a good car after all that time? Like, what maintains its ability? Like, if I look at such and such model and it has 200,000 miles on it, is that an absolute deal breaker or does it have another 100,000? There's so many things to consider. It just seems exhausting.
Well, sure. And actually, this does touch on a libertarian precept in that buying a car, whether it's a new car or a used car, is kind of a very individualized thing because we're all different and we have different skill sets. For example, if you, and I don't want to make a patriarchal sexist comment here because it could apply to either sex, but let's say that you have a teen boy or a teen girl, and one of them is more mechanically adept, let's say, than is run of the mill. And so that person could potentially deal with a car that might need some tweaking or some fixing every now and again. Whereas if you have somebody who knows nothing about cars, doesn't particularly care about the car, other than it gets reliably from A to B, then you're looking at a different kind of parameter there in terms of what you should be looking at. In general, my counsel is to go for something that's blue chip. And there are a number of models in that category that are almost impossible to go wrong with, even if they do have 200,000 miles on them. And they include, predictably, models from Toyota, such as the Corolla and also the Camry, and models that are related to them, including the Avalon and also some of the crossover SUVs like the RAV4. Similarly, from Honda, the Civic is an excellent little car. The Accord is an excellent car. Really hard to go wrong with those, with one asterisk and caveat, and that is the key critical thing with any used car, which is how well was it treated by its prior owner in terms of maintenance. That's everything. You can start out with a fantastic car that was wonderfully built, well-designed, but if it was abused by the person who had it before you, it could be the worst car you ever bought. So it's very, very important to look at the maintenance records and also to have the vehicle looked over by somebody who's competent to do that before you commit to buying it.
Ah, okay. So, but how would I do that? It's sitting there on the dealer's lot.
Well, you can. What we want to do is seek out an independent mechanic, not that store's mechanic, who would go over the vehicle for you. Of course, it's going to have a cost attached to it. It might pay $75 or whatever to have them put it on the lift and look it over and check it out, see whether there's any evidence of prior accident damage, see whether there's any indication of excess wear and tear, to check out vital systems like the brakes, to see whether there is rust, anything of that nature, as a condition of purchase. And any reputable seller will be fine with that. You know, if you're showing serious interest in buying this vehicle, you just want some psychological security, some peace of mind that you're not inheriting somebody else's money pit. They're going to be okay with that. If they're not okay with that, go somewhere else.
Okay, fair enough. The thing is, in terms of a budget for a car, you have a kid who, you know, will probably will work in her spare time and, you know, probably do okay and share an apartment with somebody and do her best to, you know, be responsible financially. I guess to some extent, it depends on where, just like with a purchase of anything, depends on where in the country you are. But I'm trying to think of what should she shoot for? And like, should she, if she were to finance it, I would buy the car outright. She can make the payments to me. Now, of course, I can buy her a car if I want to. I could just say, here's a car. But I don't know. As she's getting started, I think it's good for her to understand what budgeting is and working for things and this and that. I just wish I could get a sense of, because like, for example, I think when it comes to buying houses, they have some kind of metric, and I don't even know if it's true or not, that you should buy a house where the monthly payment you have to make is like one third of your monthly income or something like right. that. I don't know what to do when it comes with cars.
Well, cars are different because really you're talking about essentially a disposable appliance, not a durable good, not, you know, house is a qualitatively different thing. I would steer towards something that is not particularly desirable on the marketplace. Not that there's anything wrong with it per se, it's just not something that people lust after. One of the greatest examples of that is, and here it comes, a minivan, a used minivan, which could actually turn out to be a fantastic vehicle for a kid just starting out going to college because, you know, you do a lot of peregrination when you're that age. You know, you're traveling off to college and then after that, maybe you're going to go to another state to look for work. And a minivan is wonderfully useful for that, you know, tremendously roomy vehicle. And when you're 19, 20 years old, it's a comfortable car to sleep in, too, if it comes down to that. And because they're just not that desirable, they're very utilitarian. People buy them to haul kids around. And what happens? Your kids are going to spill juice, make a mess. So the interior is probably going to have a lot of stains on the seats. The paint's probably going to have some scratches and the bodywork's going to have some dings. But who cares? You know, if you get a blue chip one like a Toyota Sienna van, for example, or the equivalent from Honda, you've got a vehicle that has the same basic guts as a Camry or an Accord, which means a largely bulletproof drivetrain that's going to go for 200, 250,000 miles or more without needing anything from you. And you're going to pay a whole lot less for something like that than you would for a vehicle that's popular, that people want for all the market obvious reasons.
That's funny. You would think, yeah, of course, there's nothing more to me unfashionable than driving a minivan. As someone who, out of sheer necessity, had to drive one for a number of years. You know, now we're down to four kids at home, and then the fourth one will be gone. It'll be down to three. But we just absolutely needed that. And then I found out that there was a third row option for one of the cars I was looking at that was less embarrassing to drive. But But on the other hand, you would think, though, that the sheer size of the vehicle, I haven't looked at what their resale prices are on the used car market, would mean that they would still have to be kind of expensive. So you're telling me that I could conceivably, same model year, let's say 2008, a Toyota Sienna, if they made them in 2008, and a Toyota Camry might actually be the same price?
Well, comparable. Okay. You know, comparable, because the Camry is more popular. And obviously, as you say, it is a bigger vehicle, but you're getting more vehicle and you're getting more usefulness out of it in a lot of ways. And something else that's important as a parent is that that minivan is a big, sturdy vehicle. So if your child does get into an accident, it's going to afford the child a lot more protection than something smaller.
Yeah. Yeah. What would you recommend? As I say, I'm planning to just buy the vehicle outright and kind of, you know, have her make the payments to me. But suppose I weren't in that position. I couldn't help her to that extent. What would be the next best thing that she would, like maybe we would go in together on a down payment for her? Like, what do you recommend both from a car buyer standpoint, also from a parent standpoint?
You know, financing used cars is dicey because the interest rates on those things will sometimes absolutely kill you, particularly.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're considerably higher than they are for new cars, which now, you know, they're essentially nil. They're very, very low interest rates on the new cars. So that, of course, matters significantly when you factor it out over the course of the loan. And that has to do with the fact that the new car has a lot more value to begin with, obviously, than the used vehicle, which is already depreciated to a great extent. So the smart thing to do with buying used vehicles, if possible, is to pay cash for them, or at least to put down as sizable a down payment as you possibly can, so that you can pay the thing off as quickly as possible.
Okay, well, that of course makes sense. But now I'm wondering, could it conceivably make sense, instead of going the used car route, to take advantage of super low interest rates and just get a very, very low-end new car, like a Nissan Versa, let's say?
Absolutely.
And try that?
Absolutely. That's a vehicle that has a brand new sticker price, I think around $15,000, if I remember correctly. There's also the Hyundai Accent. There are a couple of cars that you could still buy brand new that have MSRPs or sticker prices around $15,000, and that's pretty dirt cheap. And if you sign up for a six-year loan with a very low interest rate, you're probably going to be paying, I don't know, $199-$200 a month for that. It's very manageable. The big hit there is going to be insurance for a young driver. That's the asterisk. So you want to juggle these variables. I would make some phone calls before you decide what you're going to do and call up your insurance company and say, look, hypothetically, if my 18-year-old daughter were to buy this Nissan Versa, what would the policy cost be?
Right. Because obviously the cost to replace the car is going to be three, four times more than that used car. Yeah.
Yes. And if it's a new car and you have a loan on it, obviously you have to have full coverage on it. You can't just get the state minimums, which is one way to reduce the cost of insurance, because after all, if there's a loss, you know, they want to have the whole thing covered. Yeah. Something else to consider too, it may not be applicable to you, but it is to some people. In my state, there is a vehicle property tax that's based on the book value of the car. So if you were to buy a new vehicle with a $15,000 value, you know, you're going to get dunned every year substantially. It's not it's a pretty considerable amount. To give you some sense of it, I'm still getting hit for, I think it's $150 a year on my now 20-year-old Nissan pickup by the state of Virginia for the car tax.
Oh, geez, I forget about these things sometimes.
It's really important to know about them before you commit.
Yeah. Now, listen, I'm sorry, we'll get off this because I realize that maybe there's only a limited audience that is interested in this, but I feel like everybody should have some reason to have some interest in this sort of topic. So one last thing. I've actually driven a Hyundai Accent. We had one back in, I guess that car has been around a long time because I'm pretty sure I had one in the late 90s.
Yep.
So we drove that for a couple of years and it drove great. It was fun to drive, actually. I mean, it wasn't the kind of car that as soon as you get on the highway, you're going to hit 85 and you can overtake anybody instantly, which is what I do in my car now. Like sometimes if I pull out, I never cut anybody off or I never pull out where I think it's not reasonable, but I've seen in my rearview mirror cars that are really, really speeding up just as I've come out of my housing development. And I think, I don't know what speed you think I'm going to go, like you need to suddenly pass me, but you watch. You're not even going to pass me. All right. So don't worry. We're safe here. But okay, so you can't do that. But it really is a fun car. And this day and age, what comes standard, even in a car like that, would have been considered unimaginable luxuries 30 years ago.
They're opulent. I mean, they all come now with power windows, locks, air conditioning, usually a pretty good stereo. And one thing that a car like that does come with, which you almost can't find anymore in any other car, is a manual transmission, which makes the thing a whole lot more fun to drive.
But hold on a minute. I don't know how to drive a manual car, and so I can't teach her. So I think she's got to go automatic. And okay. I know you're probably a purist, and it's a terrible thing for me to say that, but
it's not at all. It's horses for courses, you know. And frankly, as much as I love manual transmissions, I get it. You know, I have the luxury of living in a very rural area where there's very little traffic. In an environment like that, it's fun to drive a manual car. It kind of stinks to drive a manual car when you're, you know, putting from light to light in heavy suburban or urban traffic.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's probably going to be where she is for the time being. All right, I should move along. It does seem to me like the Versa is less expensive than the Accent, as I've been searching.
They're very close. They're, I think, in the high 14s, low 15s, roughly speaking.
But even the used market, if you Google used Hyundai Accents, even from 2017, some of them are going for almost 18 to 20.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Whereas the Versa new is cheaper than that.
Yeah. The other day I was reading about this, and over the course of the last 11 months, you probably are aware of this stat too. The average price of used cars has gone up something like 31%.
That's insane.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Well, all right, let's move on to some other items. I was very interested in your piece that you had not too long ago at ericpetersautos.com or epautos.com on so-called planned obsolescence, which initially you explained this way. You said that in the old days, the way this worked was then in the next model year, the car would look, you know, somewhat sleeker, more modern.
They would change the grill or the bumper.
Yeah. And it would make you feel like, well, I really should have that really sharp-looking one, not this old-fashioned one. Even though the old-fashioned one from a year ago has so much more power left in it, it's got so much more service, flow of service coming out of it, you really don't need to get that. But you just want to, because look at how sharp and nice it looks. But today, the way planned obsolescence works out has more to do with, let's say, I know a guy in the libertarian world who really, really needed to get his kids around in a minivan, and it needed a new transmission, and it was like a 2008. You know what that means.
Oh, yeah.
The car's worth $5,000, and guess how much the transmission costs?
$5,000.
Yeah. So talk to us about that.
Back in the day, you know, GM and Ford were accused of this whole planned obsolescence thing on the basis of the aesthetic changes model year to model year, in that they tried to get people to feel like that they were dated and, you know, not hip and cool if they hadn't gotten the latest car. But if you are immune to that sort of persuasion, you could look at your vehicle and say, hey, I like this thing and it suits me just fine and it works just fine, more to the point, and you can continue to drive it pretty much as long as you wanted to continue to drive it. The difference today is that these new cars have so many built-in failure points, in part because of the tremendous complexity that has been built into them. A good example is that transmission that your friend had to deal with, that when that key component fails, the cost to replace it relative to the value of the vehicle is so high that you're just going to say, I'm not doing that. You know, you put $5,000 into a $5,000 minivan and you still have a $5,000 minivan. And then what's going to fail next? You know, the electronic climate control is going to go out on you and now you're going to spend another $2,500 on the thing. Forget about it. So that's how they kind of coerce and push people into getting the next new vehicle. Now, the catch there is most people can no longer afford to do that. So, you know, it's serial debt. You just go from making one payment to a new payment to a next payment. You fold over what you still owed on your old vehicle into the payment for the new one, and you never get out of debt. And what happens thereby is you become ensurfed to these payments that you never stop making for vehicles. And it's really a sad thing, in my opinion.
Hey, folks, it's that time of year, time for New Year's resolutions. So I want to share with you an important message from our sponsor, Policy Genius. One thing you've been putting off and you know you should do is getting life insurance for people who depend on you. And an easy, super easy way to do that, and a way that helps save you a lot of money to boot, is through Policy Genius. Policy Genius is not an insurance company. They're a broker that helps insurance shoppers like you understand your options. So here's what you do. You go to policygenius.com, answer a few questions about yourself, and in minutes, you can work out how much life insurance coverage you need and compare personalized quotes to find your best price. You could save 50% or more on life insurance by comparing quotes with Policy Genius. Their licensed experts will help you understand your options and apply for a policy. You can trust them to offer unbiased help and advocate for you at every step until you're covered. They don't add on extra fees or sell your information to third parties. They have thousands of five-star reviews. And since 2014, Policy Genius has helped over 30 million people shop for insurance. So head to policygenius.com to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. I'm curious about what Biden has been up to when it comes to cars, because I've been a little bit distracted by what he's been up to on
everything else.
Everything else, right? The mandates and everything else. But, you know, of course, there are other kinds of mandates, not just vaccine ones.
Yeah.
And I am interested in what the evolution of the car market is going to look like in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we have states like California that want to accelerate the process, so to speak. But just in terms of the U.S. as a whole, is there anything that the Biden people have been doing that would tend to push the market artificially toward electric cars?
Yeah, absolutely. What he did just a couple of weeks ago was to issue what amounts to a de facto ban on vehicles that aren't electric, or at least partially electric, meaning hybrid vehicles, by kicking up the federal corporate average fuel economy mandatory minimums. These are the standards that all car companies have to meet, to about 50 miles per gallon by the 2026 model year. Now, what that means is that the only cars that can meet that standard are small hybrids like the Toyota Prius and a couple of others that are on the market. And it's going to not prohibit cars that don't meet that standard from being available for sale, but make them considerably more expensive to buy via the gas guzzler taxes that are imposed by the government on the vehicles that don't meet that standard. That makes them less affordable. That means fewer people can afford to buy them. That creates an incentive for the manufacturers to stop producing them. What's happening is they're attempting to create a kind of parity between electric cars and conventionally powered cars in terms of the cost by artificially raising the cost of non-electric cars to the high cost of electric cars. This is one of the big problems, in my opinion, with electric cars. I get accused of being anti-EV. I'm not anti-EV. I'm anti the forcing of EVs. And whether you think climate change is real, whether you think electric cars are fabulous or not, at the end of the day, the bottom line is if people can't afford to buy them, it really doesn't matter how good or bad they are, right? You know, I'd like to own a Cirrus Vision jet. I think it would be really nifty if I could run down to the General Aviation Terminal and jump in my $2.1 million personal jet and fly to wherever I want to go. The problem is I can't afford that. And the problem with these electric cars that start around $40,000, by the way, is that most people simply cannot afford that. So they're kind of pushing us out of cars generally, and they're coming out of the closet about that. The UK, I can't remember who he is, you probably caught this too, the Minister of Transportation in the UK actually publicly said that the goal is to eliminate the privately owned car. And that's what this is all about at the end of the day.
Yeah. So two things about that. The 2026 model year is only four model years away. We just entered 2022.
Exactly right.
And to expect something like that, that's unbelievably unreasonable. But secondly, I've been much too naive over the years. It's not like it's just some unfortunate side effect that, oh, by the way, these cars are going to be very, very expensive and difficult for the average person to buy. I don't like the expression, that's a feature, not a bug, because it just annoys me. But that is exactly what's going on here. These are people who have disliked the independence that comes from independent car ownership from the very beginning. And you see this, by the way, you can see left-wingers who don't like it because people will be less amenable to being planned and managed if they have that kind of independence. But then there are also traditionalist conservatives. You know, I like Russell Kirk, but he never learned to drive a car. He had other people drive him around, and he referred to the car as a mechanical Jacobin. So that is to say, the car can uproot you from all your inherited identities because you could just up and go somewhere else and forge some new identities. And this is destabilizing for societies. And I feel like if you come from some you-know-what hole that's filled with terrible people, then get in your car and go make new identities for yourself, you know? All this stuff be damned as far as I'm concerned. But I think they really do. It's an elite contempt for the average person. That is what is being manifested here.
No question. No question. And we no longer have to speculate because we have their own statements now. For many decades, they kept this stuff, sotto voce, you know, under the table, and they would talk about it amongst themselves. And I'd be privy to some of this because I attended some of these planning meetings. You probably have as well, or gotten the minutes and read them. But now they're really blatant about it. You know, and they use terms like road dieting, you know, to take an avenue down from two lanes to one so as to make it less convenient for people to drive, to eliminate parking spaces in downtown. All of these kinds of things are designed to get the average person out of the car. And an interesting thing about it is, of course, as with all of these things, these same elites that are pushing all of this, they themselves aren't going to be deprived of their personal mobility.
Of course not. No way. No way. Right. It just means they don't have to rub elbows with any of these people who are beneath them anymore. And that's a lot of what training people to be accustomed to just staying home a lot and making it harder for them to travel. It's so they can go to their little vacation resorts and not have to deal with the occasional uppity American who somehow scraped together the dough to do that himself.
Yeah, the American carscape is reviving the Soviet carscape, where you had the apparatchiks. You had Stalin in his Packard limo going through the gate at the Kremlin. And, you know, the people would stand there and take off their caps and watch as he went by. And we're seeing the same thing. You know, you go to D.C. and you'll see these motorcades of gigantic armored SUVs with big V8 engines, by the way, not electric motors, driving the elite to wherever they want to go at top speed. It's not for us, the little people, to have access to that sort of thing. And it's not just about mobility. There's an economic factor as well that's operative here. A lot of people like being able to, for example, buy more house out in the country or even the suburbs, where as opposed to having to work closer to where they work in a city where everything is more expensive because you're downtown. So they make that bargain. They think, okay, well, it's worth it to me to drive 45 minutes or an hour to my place of work because, you know, I've got a nice little house now and I've got a backyard for my kids to play in. It's a safe neighborhood. It's better for them. They want to take that option away from working and middle-class Americans.
Before we wrap up, I want to talk about your picks for 2022. You always do interesting reviews as the new models get rolled out. So let's talk about cars and forget about people on a budget for the time being. Just tell me what you like. Is there anything that you like, gives you pleasure to drive?
Yeah, I've got one, and carpe diem, seize the day. Go out and get a new Dodge Charger or Challenger or V8-powered Ram truck or Jeep product before they stop making them. Dovetailing with what we were just talking about a little while ago, Stellantis, which is the parent company, the conglomerate that owns the Dodge and the Chrysler and the Jeep and the Ram truck brands, has decided or announced that they're going to stop selling their big, wonderful V8 engine because of what Biden has decreed recently. So these wonderful, big American cars with big V8 engines that are wonderful to drive and very affordable, by the way, you can pick up a V8-powered Challenger or Charger for about $35,000, which, to put it in some context, is about the same as you pay to have something miserable and wretched that's electrified like a Nissan Leaf. So gather ye rosebuds while you may.
That sounds like good advice. Is there anything that you drove or that you've been writing about that seems disappointing to you or that you would urge people away from?
Well, you know, boy, that is more a subjective thing. There really isn't anything that's Airfingers quotes bad on the market anymore in terms of just being shoddily put together or poorly built. It's emotionally flat. It's drab. What we're getting to the point of now is what I styled the universal transportation appliance, which takes the form of the crossover SUV. And it's become so difficult to tell one of these from another. They're all fundamentally the same, other than the badge. And, you know, this one's got an 8-inch touch screen and that one's got a 9-inch touch screen. And it's a real challenge for me as a guy who does car reviews to come up with 2,000 words about one crossover versus another one.
I think we've gotten to the point where car manufacturers can no longer figure out what extra features they could possibly pack into these cars. So now they're adding features that I don't even want. Like my car, I don't want to say what it is. I'll tell you after we get off. But I got a new car sometime in the past year. And the thing will not shut up. I get out of the car and the keys are in it. Beep, beep, beep. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I know the keys are in it because my friends are in it and they're not going to drive away with the car just because the key, you know, or if a car is running and I walk out with the keys in it, I get beep, beep, beep. Now I can figure out ways to shut this off. Then also, if I don't hurry up and lock it within, I don't know, like 15 or 20 seconds of getting out of the car, then it will lock itself and beep. Now, what if it's 3 a.m? So I'm always racing for the little remote thing to make sure I lock this thing before it makes a racket. Shut up. Why won't this car? I want to take it to the dealership. And I know I could go through the 800-page manual and figure all this out. I want to take it to the dealership and say, would you shut this car up for heaven's sake? I don't need or want any of this.
You know, it's ironic. In a way, we've never had it so good in that the least and the most humble car, like, for example, the Versa that we were talking about earlier, It has the things that when you and I were kids would have been considered just incredibly fabulous luxuries that you generally only found in Cadillacs and Lincolns. You've got climate control, air conditioning. Of course, you have power windows and locks. You've got a really good stereo. So as you say, it's really difficult now to differentiate between, say, a $30,000 car like a well-equipped Camry and a Mercedes S-Class that's a $100,000 car. And they keep throwing these electronic baubles at the car. And the problem with electronics is that they're inherently cheap. I mean, it's easy. You know, Mercedes puts in a flat screen display in the gauge cluster. Well, whoop-de-doo. You can get that in a Hyundai that costs $27,000 because it doesn't take a lot of dinero to put in a flat screen. That's the one thing that's getting cheaper. I wrote an article a couple of months back in which I mused and suggested that perhaps particularly the high-end brands might reconsider and go back to the way things were when things were hand-done. You know, that's something that you can't cheapen. Put real wood in a luxury car. Put real metal, real brushed metal appliques. And how about chronograph-style gauges and things like that that would be really neat and special and something worth paying the higher dollars for?
Now, that is an interesting possibility, because as you were sitting here describing all this and saying, look, these are things that you could get in a mid-range car, then it makes me wonder, given that we've got to a point, as you say, where there's nothing on the market that's really just badly put together, there's certainly no Yugo in the U.S.
Nothing
market.
Like that. Nope.
So is there other than, at least in the old days, you could say, I'm driving this BMW because I love the German engineering. We all know you're driving it to show off. Like every last soul on earth knows that's why you're driving it. But it seems like now there's even less reason to do that other than flat out just to show people that you're successful, right? And by the way, I don't care if somebody wants to do that. I've done it. I don't care, you know, but I just want to know, is there any really, really compelling reason for me to spend the extra $50K or whatever?
No, not anymore. It's really quite something. It's all essentially about the money. Now, I'm frequently distressed by wasted potential. And the thing that, one of the things that really bothers me about the landscape today is that the technology is available. The manufacturing techniques are available that we could have phenomenal cars. We could have phenomenal choice in cars. There is no reason why, for example, they couldn't produce an $8,000 car with air conditioning that was light and efficient, got 60 miles per gallon, would be a great car for your daughter, for example, that she could easily buy and could afford and would give her mobility. But because of all these rent-seeking and regulatory regimes that are out there, we have kind of a consolidation and this homogeneity, this Sovietization of the car business, where, you know, you're essentially getting this one government-mandated style of car, one size fits all, when it really doesn't fit anybody particularly well.
Well, I am going to have her listen to this episode, is all I can say. We're going to talk through our options sometime later this week. But I appreciate your time. Your website, it's ericpetersautos.com, but even faster is just your initials, epautos.com. And I want to remind people that even though I'm not what you would call a car guy, I have no specialized knowledge in it, I'm not even really that interested in them, other than I obviously need one. I use one every day. But despite that, I make a monthly donation to Eric because he has the only libertarian car site, as far as I know, in the whole world, or even if there might be another one, which I've never heard of, there's nobody who's been doing it as long as Eric. And this is not, you know, nobody makes $1 million doing free car reviews and offering free advice and free reporting. So as libertarians, we have to decide, do we believe what we say about, well, in a free society, we would all voluntarily encourage people to do things like this. Okay, well, how about we start now? So help out Eric and benefit as well from what Eric is doing over at epautos.com. So Eric, thanks again. I'll link to your site at tomwoods.com/2043. And until next time, thanks.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate you having me on.
All right, folks, let me tell you about the next episode, 2044. I think what's been happening, again, kind of like what I said at the beginning of this episode, is that with the mandates and restrictions and the virus craziness, I can say, at least speaking for myself, that I have indeed been distracted from other issues that I should have been paying attention to. And I think when there isn't an outright hot war going on, it's also very easy to neglect foreign policy because we feel like, yeah, we know vaguely that it's probably a train wreck, but I don't have time to get to it. I have to focus on what's really front and center in my life. But I think that's a mistake, that there are things going on in foreign policy that we need to be aware of. So do not be tempted to skip episode 2044. We need a briefing on foreign policy, and particularly relations between the U.S. and Russia, which is a very, very important topic. So Scott Horton returns to talk to us tomorrow about that subject. So make sure you tune in. And if you like and appreciate what's going on here at the Tom Woods Show, and you would like a haven of normal people to talk to, well, one of the many benefits you get as a supporting listener of the Tom Woods Show is membership inside the Tom Woods Show Elite, which I sometimes call Normal Person Central. Get access to that and warm my heart by visiting supportinglisteners.com. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.